We love the wild women, outrageous plots, and insanely hot hunks from these campy films from the 60s and 70s. Faster, Pussycat, Kill Kill, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, Myra Breckinridge, and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. Despite the success of these movies as camp classics, after the film's release, these Hollywood hunks disappeared. Even today, they don't have much of a social media profile to celebrate their past glory. What happened to them?
What was it about being a Hollywood hunk that made these men run away screaming from show business? Today, we're joined by Peaches Christ, who for the past two decades has been thinking about and parodying many of these campy films in her wildly successful film showcase, Midnight Mass.
Listen as we talk about the lives of these mysterious Hollywood hunks and why they may have deleted themselves from show business and the phone book for good.
Why being a movie star isn't as glamorous as it seems.
Plus, check out photos of what these hunks look like today and in their past glory on our website, feastoffun.com. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Hello.
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 Who is this?
Cocksuckers.
Oh, hi.
How you doing, Peaches Christ?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Good. How are things in Maryland?
Very relaxing and spring-like.
Oh, you're so lucky to have spring where you are. We still have winter.
Oh, really? No, it's the leaves are all coming out on the trees, and there's lots of tulips and flowers everywhere, you know.
Is it making you horny?
Yeah.
Are you spending spring at Mother's house, Peaches?
I
hear it's lovely there this time of year.
Yes, it's very nice. It's a good time to be here. I had a gig in New York this past weekend, and then this coming weekend, I have a gig in Philadelphia. And so it didn't really make sense to fly back from New York to California only to come back to Pennsylvania. So it was the perfect opportunity to come down and stay in Maryland, you know, during the week and be here and visit. And it's been really nice. It's been mellow, and I've been able to kind of communicate with San Francisco because we have a big show next weekend in San Francisco. So I've been doing a lot of Skyping, and technology is amazing. I can be here and still working there. Thank you, science.
It's all working in your favor. Next weekend, is it Spice World?
Yeah, we're doing Spice World.
Awesome.
I've
never seen that movie.
Yeah.
How bad is that movie?
It's pretty bad.
It's really bad. But here's the thing. It's so bad. I mean, I was kind of oblivious to the Spice Girls. I mean, I knew who they were. They were a huge phenomena, you know, 20 years ago when they came out. And but I was too cool for it. You know, it wasn't for me. And then I went and saw their movie, and it completely changed my opinion of them. Like, I thought it was so charming and stupid, and it reminded me of lots of the dumb movies I loved growing up as a kid, and it really endeared me to them. And I remember saying to my friend after we saw the movie, I said, "Oh my God, I wonder if someday we'll do Spice World at Midnight Mass." And here we are, you know.
And you actually brought in a British drag queen for it.
Three. Yeah. We have Cheddar Gorgeous playing the part of Sporty. And Cheddar Gorgeous is from Manchester, England. And we have Anaphylactic, or as she would say, Anaphylactic, playing the part of Posh. And she's also from Manchester. And both Anna and Cheddar were part of our Barbarella tour in the UK. And then in our show, the Richard O'Brien character and the Barry Humphries character are twisted. And so they, you know, Richard O'Brien and Barry Humphries are in Spice World. So the Barry Humphries character in our show is going to be called Lame Edna, and she's going to be played by Baby Lame from London, who's this outrageous sort of punk rock drag queen. So we've got one London queen and two Manchester queens and two RuPaul girls plus me.
Wow. You have Katya doing an English accent, which I'm sure she'll be flawless at.
Yes, we do. We have Katya doing an English accent, and I thought to myself, well, she's good at accents. Mm-hmm. I've heard her do others.
That was the criteria?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Honey Mahogany had to be black. So she's playing scary.
So you must be Ginger Spice, then.
Of course. Hello.
After the group split up?
Ginger Spice to me is the best because she gets the best clothes and has the best hair and wears the most makeup.
Did any of them come out as lesbians? I feel like one of them did.
I think it was Ginger.
Was it?
I would think it would be Sporty if any of them. I'm like, the way I wrote the show is, you know, in our version of the show, Sporty Spice is a humongous clam shucker who wants nothing but vagina and tits through the whole show. She's obsessed with all of our tits.
Well, she got it, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For the record, it was the black one, Mel B, who had a 4-year relationship with another woman.
Oh. Really?
I'm thinking Samantha Fox. That's who I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Yeah, she came out.
Touch me. I want to feel your body.
But, you know, I like all those girls. Like, I've kind of been doing my research, and I like them all. Like, they're really likable, you know?
Well, that's why they cast them in that role. I mean,
they're great.
My favorite memory of the Spice Girls was when Posh Spice was on Larry King, and he was interviewing her, and they were taking questions from like Twitter or from the internet or whatever. And somebody asked, like, why does she never smile? And then she's just like, why I don't ever smile because I really don't like my smile. And then Larry gets her to smile, and it's like watching like this jack-o'-lantern kind of like smile open up, and you're just kind of like, and you see like, and you can see it on the internet. Maybe I'll post a link up to
watch
it.
That. The whole audience sort of screams in terror.
Absolutely. And you're like, no wonder if you smiled like this, you wouldn't smile. It was kind of crazy.
Yeah, she's really likable too. Like, I love in the you guys haven't seen the movie?
No.
Oh my God. The movie is such a train wreck of epic proportion that you just you can't help but like it. And the whole time you're thinking like the script makes no sense. Like, I have to say, like, as a parody writer, usually one thing that I have going for me is, well, like, the plot is usually pretty well created. I mean, with the few exceptions like Grey Gardens, where I have to go in and invent one, you know, most of the movies we parody have a 3-act structure that I can follow. Not this one. It makes no sense. It's just a total free-for-all. You really kind of, if you ask someone like, well, what is the purpose of Spice World? Like, what did they want? What are they trying to achieve? It's kind of like, I don't know.
So it's a perfect role for Katya, then. It makes
yeah, poor Katya. No, I don't know. I hope she's read the script because, oh my God, I gave her a lot of potty humor. Like, in our show, like, Baby Spice really has the sense of humor of a child.
And she wear diapers?
Well, I don't want to give it all away, but there is poop involved, yeah.
It sounds fantastic.
So a number of years ago, we were sitting around, we were talking with Bruce Vilanch, and we were talking about some of these camp movies, and I talked to him about Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and one of the actors in it, David Gurian, who plays Harris Ellsworth, he's the manager of this rock band that comes to L.A., and they fall into this decadent lifestyle. You know, I was looking at the IMDb.
He was the manager of Thy Carry Nations?
The Carry Nations. And yeah. So every time I see like these hot guys in movies, I'll like check out on IMDb and I'll look and I'll be like, what else did they do? And I was kind of surprised, like, that was the only movie he ever made. And then I also looked at like Myra Breckinridge, and you had a Roger Heron who played Rusty Gadowski, and that was really the only movie he ever made too. Yeah. And Bruce was just like, oh yeah, Hollywood's disposable beefcake. And so I was like,
you know, I wonder if I've heard that before from him or someone else, but when you contacted me, Mark, about the idea of doing a disposable beefcake show, I was like, God, I know that I've heard of this concept before, but I actually couldn't find it, you know, on the internet. Like, I was looking to see if maybe I'd read, you know, someone's. So I don't know.
Well, you do listen to the podcast, and I may have mentioned it on the podcast before, you know, so it may have come in through that way.
I love it when people who listen to the podcast come around and tell me what I said as if it was an idea that they heard else. Like,
it happens all the time. It happens all the time. I'm like, you heard me talk about that.
Or they go up to me, they say, oh, I was arrested last weekend for stealing people's hearts. And I was like, yeah, I wonder where you got that joke from.
I think that joke is hieroglyphics on the pyramids.
That's not the.
But the reason they're saying it to me is because they heard it from me.
Because they said it from
I don't. You might want to rethink. You know which one you pull out. That example,
Bianca Box is one that gets told to me all the time. Well,
just so you know, Bianca Bucks is in my show. I use it my show. So don't even try to come and claim that.
Oh, so you're saying that it did not originate from the podcast?
No, I'm sure. I'm
call
sure
the lawyers. We need a cease and desist letter.
Vivacious is calling. She's going to come for you.
I hope Vivacious files up.
You don't take my words.
Peaches Christ, darling.
No, it's in the show. The child, Bianca, says it at the beginning of the show. She stomps her foot and says, I make the Bianca Bucks around here, so I make the decisions.
Aww. You gotta send a clip of that to Vivacious. It'll warm her Jamaican little heart.
What? When are you doing a Grace Jones View to a Kill and casting Vivacious in it?
Well, I don't know if Vivacious has seen my latest headpiece, Popcornacea, but it's a big hit.
Oh.
Ooh.
Yeah, Popcornacea is a head that sits on top of my head with a lot of bling on it.
Ooh, how's your head?
I haven't had any complaints lately.
So let's talk about the Hollywood hunks that are missing at large. And I think, you know, starting off with talking about David Gurian, who plays, is it Harris Albright or Harris?
Harris Ellsworth. Yeah.
So he just literally, and some people actually, I was reading about this elsewhere because I contact everybody I knew, including Peaches Christ, about all these guys, and he may have faked his death or hated the job so much that he legally changed his name, and literally every you know, reunion, every get together, because a lot of these people were cast in the film because they had never been in a movie before. And he hated the experience so much, like, he wouldn't even do press for it.
Well, the thing is, that movie is so over the top and it's so wild. And, you know, it's an exploitive film. And so I'm sure as an actor, he probably felt very exploited in some
degree. Yeah, I have done a Beyond the Valley of the Dolls reunion event. And at the time when we did it, God, it had to have been over 10 years ago now. I was able to get three of the stars of the film, Erica Gavin, Marsha McBroom, and John Lazar, who played Z-Man. Mm-hmm. And at the time, there was a Blu-ray celebrating the anniversary. And it was a big, big deal that the guy who played Harris had actually agreed to participate. Because it was one of the things, you know, he hadn't done anything for all those years, you know, 20 something years probably at that point. But I don't think he's done anything since either. So,
and he's pretty much disappeared. And I'm trying to find, and I found on like a message on a blog, Pop Addict, Pop Culture Addict. Somebody said that they were able to write, they left something on a message board a few years ago, and a young woman responded and said that David was her father, and he just, you know, thank you for your kind words and stuff like that, but he didn't want to be associated with the film, and he wasn't interested in being in the limelight at all. I guess, you know, the thing about this movie, too, is, you know, Valley of the Dolls starred Sharon Tate, and they re-released it after she was murdered. And then, of course, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls also deals with, like, these celebrities getting murdered, too. And so I think maybe with that whole Helter Skelter thing going on around that time, too. And also, you know, spoiler alert, the movie's very transphobic in that the killer, the murderer, the bad person is a trans man.
Now, is that been verified by Roger Ebert in the script that it, because we see... The revelation is that the killer opens up his shirt and reveals that he has breasts.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. for a lot of people watching that film, it was that he was a man who's transitioning to being a woman. Yeah. But in the script, it was yeah. that it was a woman who had transitioned to be a man.
Right. We talked to Darcy Drollinger, your good gal pal drag queen friend out in San Francisco. And she said she read the script, and the script identifies this person as a trans man.
Yeah. And John Lazar, when we did the show together, described that as well, that Russ Meyer and Roger Ebert intended it to be a trans man, meaning that Z-Man is how he wanted to present himself, but that he originally, you know, had been a mm-hmm. you know, born mm-hmm. a woman, or probably mm-hmm. lived as a woman, and want, you know, felt that he was a man.
And isn't it interesting that it's Z-Man, and like how many gender neutral people want to use the pronoun Z for their
right,
them, you know?
Right. I hadn't thought of that.
It just popped into my head just now.
I mean, I was describing this movie recently when I was up in New York this past weekend to these young dancers who are in our show. I don't remember why it came up, but it did. And I said, oh, you know, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. And of course, none of them did. And that blows my mind. And I'm thinking like, oh, you know, it starts and they start the movie and the credits actually roll backwards as the movie's starting. And they show you the finale of the movie in the first 5 minutes, you know, where Erica Gavin has the gun, you know, she's sleeping in the bed and, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden the gun, you know, is put into her mouth in an extreme close up. And she opens her eyes and there's the gun, you know, in her mouth. And, you know, they're like, no, we've never seen this. And it sounds unbelievable. And I'm like, oh, yeah. And then they blow her brains out. And that's how the movie starts, you know, and cuts to a rock performance. And, you know, and I'm describing the movie and, you know, get to, you know, describe Z-Man. And their minds were blown. Like, how could they not have known about this film?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it was just sort of sad. Like, yeah, you should know about this movie. It's, you know, it's incredible and outrageous. And, you know, it was produced by a studio. It was Russ Meyer and Roger Ebert's, you know, kind of first big studio break.
Mm. Well, you know, what did Fox RuPaul recently say about this younger generation? It's up to themselves to educate themselves.
Maybe that's what should have said to them. I should have been like, bitches, you're on your own.
it's very true in that kind of sense. You have to, if you want to know something, you have to take the effort and research it and look at it and find it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and it is definitely Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. Definitely is a camp gem that's worth checking out for sure. If not just
well,
for
I
the
hope
hot David
any
Durian.
Of your I hope any of your listeners that are listening aren't dissuaded by the news that there's a transphobic element, because mm-hmm. you know, I think it's fascinating to go back and look at cinema for both its homophobia and its sexism mm-hmm. and misogyny and its transphobia over the years. I mean, I think I don't be put off by that, you know, go and seek it out mm-hmm. and watch it. And also I think there's an interesting psychology, and we've talked about it on the podcast many times. I know, but what, you know, that many of us who are older, we're actually attracted to these characters. You know, like, I actually really, you know, when I think about it, I often identified and was fascinated with queer killers, you mm-hmm. know, and Z-Man was completely mm-hmm. fascinating to me, you know, and really, you know, the queerness of the character, even though,
and that queer,
you know,
rage,
the queer rage. I mean, at the end, oh my God, it is, you know, it is the Manson story. Mm-hmm. That's the finale of that film is the inspiration from, you know, the Charles Manson, Sharon Tate, you know, murder spree. And it's just fantastically fascinating and opulent and bizarre and horrific. And one of the best, you know, original films.
And the fashion is just to die for.
And to die for. Yeah.
Roger and Ebert, Fausto, actually, if you feel like the secret, the revelation mm-hmm. was sort of, you know, put in at the last minute, it's because it was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Roger Ebert said in the DVD commentary that that he just came up with that at the last minute just to have some big kaboom revelation. But a lot of people who are fans of the film say that the dialogue hints at the secret earlier on. Roger Ebert in the DVD said, no, it's not the case. It was just a coincidence.
Ah.
And I think he might have even talked about how the Manson murders also were added, you know, like that this had been something they'd been working on for years. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong about that. But Fausto, I was going to ask you if you knew one of the cameos in the film that I think is so interesting is that in Z-Man's party in the second act of the film where we're introduced to Z-Man and he runs in and he looks at his party and he goes, "This is my happening," and it freaks me out. You know, the woman who's wearing the black cat suit,
yes,
and looks very sexy, that's Haji from Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Isn't she wearing one of the Catwoman costumes from the old Batman TV series?
Oh, I'm not sure about that, but it's very similar, you know.
Yeah, I believe that costume is the same exact wardrobe piece from the TV show. And a lot of I was reading also a lot of set pieces from Beyond the Valley of the Dolls were also used for Myra Breckinridge.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. Hey, now we've got two segues, you guys. I set you up for one.
I haven't done my joke with, hold on.
Do your joke.
Maybe, you know, because Russ Meyers loves boobs so much. Most of his movies have so much boobs in it that he's just like, why not give the dudes boobs too?
That's pretty good, Mark.
You're welcome.
And I have an anecdote about those boobs that's very strange.
Oh, tell me about those boobs, Peach.
Okay, so when we did the reunion, this will be in a book if I ever write one, but that weekend was one of the strangest, most challenging weekends for me because of the dynamic between the three cast members. And John Lazar brought his wife with him to San Francisco. And I had them all at the same hotel. Erica Gavin, who was Vixen in the movie Vixen, and Marsha McBroom, who plays the drummer in the Carrie Nations, still so beautiful, just very, very beautiful. And really was only in, I think, Jesus Christ Superstar, maybe one other movie, you know, and left show business and married a producer and moved to New York. So Marsha really hadn't done much of these reunion type of shows. When we meet in the lobby, John Lazar sees Marsha. It's the first time they've seen each other since they made the movie. He points at Marsha and announces, "Best lover I ever had." At which point, the look on his wife's face was pure horror. And Marsha McBroom just sort of smiled and bat her eyes like she was, you know, that character in the movie all over again. Well, we go on, we have lunch, we have dinner, and more outrageous shit comes out as, you know, the weekend progresses. But what we find out on stage when I start talking about those legendary tits is that Marsha admits she still has them. She stole them from the set at the end of the movie because she was having an affair with John Lazar. And when they were done, when they wrapped those scenes, she took the tits and she has them in her apartment in New York.
Wait, she has the tits that John wore?
She has his prosthetic tits, yes.
Oh, wow.
Well, he sent me
a picture. Titty thief.
She could sell it on eBay.
She's a titty thief, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know, you know, for your nerdy cult movie fans out there, I'm a fountain of information like this. I just worry that, you know, with these youngins, the interest just isn't there anymore, but who cares?
Are you talking about RuPaul's interview in Vulture magazine?
Maybe.
Well, you know, we all have had experiences dealing with the younger generation, and they just, you know, you talk about something, and they just act like, whatever, no big deal. It's not important to me. And then then when they discover it on their own, they're like, oh my God, this is so amazing. I'm like, yeah, I told you about that 5 years ago.
But I do think that your young listeners are much better informed and more engaged and interested people, because whenever I meet your younger listeners out on the road, you know, they listen to your show because they want to know about this stuff, which is very, very refreshing.
And that's why we do it.
I don't know. You know, at the same time, I think, you know, young people really get hated on unfairly a lot, you know, because
agreed. I agree with that.
Because when, like, if somebody in their 40s behaves, you know, entitled, they call them an asshole. But when someone in their 20s behaves in an entitled way, they call them a millennial.
And truly, it's probably not much different than when we were young. You know what I mean? If you really think about it, like when I was young, the vast majority of people my age didn't give a shit about old movies. I liked old movies. I went out and found out about Russ Meyer, you know, who you know, was you know, a forgotten filmmaker when I was a kid. So, you know, I think it's probably the same now where, you know, we, you know, lump all these young people together. And really, it's like, no, the majority of young people are still tired, just like they were when we were young. And, you know.
You know who watches a lot of old.
Yeah, the exceptional few who seek out, you know, a deeper history and culture.
And you know who watches old movies like on AMC is a lot of African Americans, black people, because they would always like talk to me about like old movies. And I'm just like, how do you know about this movie? I watch it on TV. I've seen it.
Because it's
you know?
Free.
Well, yes, that's part
oh
of
my
it.
God.
We have to pay for cable. But, you know, when I was younger, people used to always like, especially black people used to tell me I look like Montgomery Clift. And like a white person their age would never know who Montgomery Clift was.
Right, right. You know?
Well, we have so many other great Hollywood hunks to talk about.
Yeah. Let's move on to Russ Meyer's other movie, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
And I just want to, for the record, my drag inspiration is Tura Satana, the shit-kicking badass who was also sort of referenced and paid homage to in Pee-wee's new film on Netflix.
Yeah, I mean not really subtly either. It was, you know, pretty overt.
Well, it was disappointing. I just want to say for the record, seeing, you know, a Tura Santana character in a movie with Pee Wee Herman, and she doesn't break his spine, or like attack him, or she doesn't really get into a fight with him. And Tura Santana was a murderer. She was
a shit kicking bitch.
She was a she demon, you know?
Yeah, but yeah, I saw the movie in the theater, and I saw it with a full audience, and I didn't know that there was going to be that Tura character. Like, I hadn't really seen a clip, or I mean, you know, maybe I really went to the movie kind of not knowing anything about it. You know, I didn't even realize that.
Wait, you saw the Pee Wee Netflix movie in a theater?
Yeah, Netflix did this thing where they bought out movie theaters in San Francisco, and you could get a free ticket. You just had to reserve it online. And I have to say, I think that experience of going to a sold out theater and seeing his movie, like just when he first appeared on screen and the whole audience erupted in cheers, you know, like that. That experience, because I've heard from people who watched it at home and were underwhelmed, and I'm like, oh, I wish you had my experience. It was amazing. I mean, the balloon sequence with him doing the balloon comedy bit was, I mean, tears, you know, because the laughing is so infectious. But I had such an emotional reaction to the movie because, one, here's this character that I love so much, that I'm so nostalgic about, and there he is. On the big screen in a new movie, and I really liked the movie. Two, it's basically a queer love story, you know, from the point of view of a young sissy who's attracted to, you know, the big tough rockabilly, you know, muscle guy, and the muscle guy is sweet and reciprocates the affection. That was beautiful and like nothing I'd ever seen before, and presented in a way that was just so refreshing and cool. And three, I didn't know that there was going to be this Tura Santana, you know, homage. And so I got very wistful thinking about, you know, my friendship with Tura and how much it would have meant to her to see herself immortalized in the new Pee Wee movie, you know? So I was like crying by the end of the movie. I just had such an intense reaction to it. I like loved it so much. But yes, I agree that she wasn't maybe as tough as the actual Varla would be, but she was also, you know, in a Pee Wee movie.
Do you know what happened to the actor Dennis Bush, who played the vegetable in Faster Pussycat Kill Kill?
I emailed my friend about him last night, who's in touch with him, and I asked, you know, because we were talking about putting the show together, if, you know, he had done any other movies, and she said that he had not, but that he's alive and well. He's done some shows and has... And my friend said, oh, yeah, he'd love to talk to you. He, you know, he's familiar with you. Because, you know, Tura and I did a a lot of shows together before she passed away. So she passed along his email address. But he's another classic example of, what did Bruce Vilanch call it?
Disposable beefcake.
Disposable beefcake, because he was so hot in that movie, my God.
And muscular and big. I mean, the
so delicious.
The scene where, like, he literally fights a car.
Yeah.
Do we want to spoil it? That's how Tura Sultana kills him.
Wow.
So for about 5 minutes on screen, Tura Sultana is trying to drive him, crush him against a wall.
And he's pushing against the car.
And he's using his Hulk-like strength to push the car back, but ultimately, you know, loses the car.
Yeah.
And they called him a vegetable because he wasn't very bright.
Yeah, and the three women, the three leads in that movie are so over-the-top sexy, and he, I think, matches. He's the male beefcake that they can all believably lust after. And, you know, and he's also really likable. But you're right. Like, he is disposable beefcake. He never did another movie. He never showed up in anything again. And all of us horny gays are left to
wonder whatever
wonder.
Happened.
Yeah, well, forever. What
is,
ever.
Is it? You know, and these are both Russ Meyer films, and you know, he's known for his exploitation films. I wonder if these guys just felt so exploited by the experience, or maybe because, you know, he was so hot for these women that the guys just kind of felt like, well, they were left in the shadow. Like, what made them go running, screaming from Hollywood?
I don't know, because you know, I was thinking about it about this concept, and I was thinking, especially with Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, I'm like, well, one might say, like, oh, well, they were hired for their bodies, so they're not really actors. So maybe they didn't have the talent that would, you know, get them more jobs. But I think that in the case of Harris, or the guy who played him in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, he's quite good. You know, he's good in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know what he was doing? The role he did on stage before he was in Valley of the Dolls? He played Rumpelstiltskin.
Oh, really?
And if you search...
Children's theater?
Yeah, children's theater in his university, I think, that he was going to. And you can Google and find pictures of a makeup artist transforming him into Rumpelstiltskin.
Oh, that's funny.
These guys were very much innocent in the sense that they didn't realize that being an actor requires doing a scene over and over again, memorizing large passages of text only to have it be rewritten at the last second, and dealing with a lot of hypocrisy and bureaucracy with the Hollywood system.
And the other weird thing about most of the examples that we came up with, and I don't know if this is because this is what most of them were or because of the way we were thinking, is that they're blonde.
They were discriminated against because they were so white.
I don't know. Maybe.
Well, blondes are always evil. What did Bart Simpson say? Like, the blondes are always evil in movies. You know, they're like the Nazis. Well, like Peter Henwood, who played Rocky in Rocky Horror Picture Show, for the longest time, the only thing on his IMDb was Rocky Horror. I assumed it was the only movie he'd ever made. But sometimes, you know, for whatever reason, they decide to update their IMDb page. And so he actually made, like, a couple of other films, but, like, very, very, very small roles.
Right. Nothing. Like, they're all kind of notable for one big movie.
Right.
And even if they've been in other movies, they're usually movies where you go, you never heard of them. Right. And certainly their performance wasn't notable.
And I was kind of looking over one of the films, like it's on YouTube, Tam Lin, and it was directed by Roddy McDowall. And it stars Ava Gardner, you know, the beautiful Ava Gardner. You know, this is in the 70s now, so she's a little bit older. But she plays a witch, and she lives in this fabulous mansion out in this secluded area. And she's surrounded by all these jet-setting freaks. You know, that she like has come to her house because she like weaves a spell over them. So in some ways, it's a little Rocky Horror-ish in that kind of sense.
Well, it seems like he was like cast before and since his role in Rocky Horror in very similar roles where his very muscular body and very unusual body for the time period. Because, you know, it's like steroids weren't as prevalent. People didn't understand how to build muscle as much as they do today. Right. There was not like a gym culture or like, you know, supplements. Right.
But remember, he wasn't made for you. Wait, no, he was made
like
for you.
I don't like a man with too many muscles.
Because you do like a man with muscles.
But so Peter Henwood, he was cast in Rocky Horror Picture Show over the guy, Rainer Burton, who originated the role in the original London stage show, because he had screen experience playing the Greek god Hermes in The Adventures of Ulysses, mm-hmm. in a series on British television in the late 60s.
So he looks good in shorts, because Hermes always wore little shorts.
But I got to tell you, I've seen photos of Rainer Burton today and Peter Hinwood, and Rainer Burton kept up his looks.
Oh, really?
He kept lifting weights. And to this day, Rainer Burton still is a sexy,
really?
Sexy older man.
And yeah. What did Peter Hinwood just said? He stopped acting because he can't act. He's like, I'm a terrible actor. So he went on to just become, you know, he ran an antique shop.
Well, this is what the quote he said.
Okay.
I can't act. I cringe with embarrassment every time I see myself on film. Oh, I relish a quiet and peaceful life.
That's funny. Yeah.
But Rainer Burton, who was asked what he thought of Peter Hinwood, he said, very truthfully, Peter Hinwood was made to look a bit like a Barbie doll in the film. Rocky has more substance than the film gives him credit for. I think after the movie, a lot of productions were influenced by the film, and the character suffered because of that. I've often looked at actors playing Rocky and thought to myself, they aren't allowed the opportunity to develop the character that I had been given.
Well, it must suck to have your stage role, you know, taken away from you when a big movie comes out like that.
Well, didn't that happen in All About Evil? Like the person who played Peaches Christ wasn't you. They found some like a person in a homeless shelter.
I'm like, what?
I'm trying to make a shady joke.
My heart sort of stopped because I was thinking, yeah, you're right, because my friend Jen Tare played Deborah, and she was replaced by Natasha Lyonne.
Mm. Oh, really?
Yeah, my friend Jennifer played Deborah in the original, so it was really, really awkward the day that they were in a scene together.
And she's like, this was supposed to be my role.
Kind of, and they sat down, and they faced each other, and they're in a scene where they're across a desk from each other, and I don't know if this is true or not, but apparently Natasha was like, before the scene started, she said to Jennifer, I'm Deborah now.
No way.
I believe it. I believe it. Jennifer swears it's true.
In a malicious way or trying to be funny or shady?
I think shady, because I think Natasha is the kind of actress who on the set, when she would be in that Deborah persona, especially when Deborah later in the movie, the character becomes more and more wicked. Natasha would stay wicked in between takes. And, you know, she could say things where you'd look at her like, what? But I would actually encourage it and enjoy it because I felt like it kept her ready to go, you know? So I really believe it because Jennifer said, I was frustrated because Jennifer is really, really great and really talented, but you could tell there was something off her game. And so I pulled her out into the hall and I said, what's going on? You know, like, and she said, oh my God, I think she intentionally is trying to throw me. And I said, oh no. She's just being Deborah. I shouldn't even be talking about this probably.
Oh, we'll take it out.
Does this mean Natasha Lyonne sexually harasses her co-stars in Orange is the New Black since she plays kind of a compulsive sex addict?
I bet she flirts with them aggressively. Mm-hmm. I bet she does. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could almost promise you that she does. I think that she is that committed. And Natasha is not a lesbian, you know, but I bet she hits on the women.
Are a little bit bi.
Of course. And Natasha is totally queer. You know what I mean? This is a woman who's as queer as it gets, you know, but she, you know, her boyfriend is Fred Armisen right now and has been for a while. So I know that she likes the D. The deep comedy dick.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, the Rocky Horror Picture Show event that they're going to do with Laverne Cox on Fox coming up, the part of Rocky is going to be played by Staz Nair, who really doesn't have much acting credits. He's a model, and he's been like in one other thing, Badoozle or something like that. But I mean, he's certainly dark hair and a tan, that's for sure.
Well, we'll have to see if he becomes a disposable hunk.
You know, he just might be. Into the trash with you, Stas.
Do you guys think Peter Hinwood is gay? Because he started his career as a photographer, mm-hmm. then he became a model, and then he was doing the beefcake roles for British television then when he got into mm-hmm. Rocky Horror. And then since then, he became an antique dealer. Mm. And has a
gay,
and has a very, very colorful collection of photos of the inside of his home on Pinterest.
Oh, wow.
That we'll post a link to. 100%
homosexual.
And there's a bunch of nude photos that he's done, and he has a nice, girthy dick. It's long, it's wide, it's
and we're beautiful. Putting links to that on the website. So if you dick pigs, vintage dick pigs, want to see
from
Peter,
a known homosexual, mm-hmm.
from a known homosexual from an iconic film, you mm-hmm. got to go check it out because it is a nice dick. Yeah.
I guess he found the gold pants that he wore in the movie, and in 1994 he sold it to the Hard Rock Cafe. So you can go,
where it still hangs to this day.
It still hangs.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's which one?
I think it's the one in Florida.
I think it's I want to say it's like a North Carolina or some homophobic state. It's on his IMDb page, I believe. Yeah. So what are the other?
Let me dig that gold pants here. Yeah, so it's I think it's in Australia.
Australia now.
Oh, you know what they do? They take the merchandise and they tour it around.
Oh.
So, like, I don't know where it might be, you know, but it might be in the surfer's paradise in Australia. So we don't really know.
So what are the other movies, camp classics, Myra Breckinridge, which is a movie based on a book by Gore Vidal. And the book is supposed to be very good. I haven't read it, but the movie just bombed at the box office. The critics hated it. And it's really just a weird, fucked up kind of movie.
Gore Vidal hated it, too.
Oh, yeah. You know, and so the storyline is basically this person, Myron, goes and has a gender reassignment surgery in Europe and then comes back as Raquel Welch as Myra Breckinridge. And goes to her uncle pretending to be her, you know, her dead name's widow, and he tries to get money from him, and instead he gives her a job at the acting school, and then she kind of becomes enthralled with this Rusty Gadowski, who's an actor, who is our next list of the disposable hunks, because Roger Herron, I guess he had done one movie that was uncredited in Paint Your Wagon, which is kind of weird too, because it's like also sexually a weird movie, because it's Clint Eastwood and I think Lee Isaacs. No, I forget his name, but Lee Marvin, and it's a musical, and in it they share a wife. So it's kind of like they're living like this three-way relationship, and it's like a strange movie, but he's uncredited in it. So like the only movie that he really has a credit in is in Myra Breckinridge. And I wonder, you know, because this movie, they say the production was just so horrendous, that working with Mae West was so horrible. And then of course in this movie, Raquel Welch fucks him. She pegs him because she puts on like a strap. She tops him.
Yeah.
Well, she doesn't put on a strap on. She still kept her genitalia.
No, she has like, I think she put some strap on. She pegs them.
Oh.
She does something, yeah.
Because it's established in the film that she had a gender reassignment
surgery. They called her sex changer.
A sex changer.
Yeah.
Well, I read the book and seen the movie, mm-hmm. and I can tell the listeners this. Mm-hmm. If you want a fascinating look at, to me, what makes Gore Vidal so spectacularly fascinating and interesting is that this man who wrote this book, Myra Breckinridge, went on to become, you know, a major American spokesperson for history and culture in a way that was as big as it gets, you know, mm-hmm. in the late 60s. And so when you read this book, it's kind of mind blowing to think that he wrote this book when he did, and that it came out and it was so successful. I mean, it came out, I think, in 1968 or 67 or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the book obviously came out before. And so it's, to me, you read the book and you think, wow, what a brave writer. And then I think probably it was a nightmare for him to experience the film, which he was also kind of an openly queeny, bitter, sassy, very, very smart man. Mm. And I think when you read the book and then you see the movie, you totally get it because the book is brilliant. It's so good. You'll read it within like a couple hours. Like you'll pick it up and you just get sucked in and it's so fabulous. And then you see the movie and it's almost like a Looney Tunes train wreck. Mm-hmm. Like completely like the tone is completely different. The whole thing is a mess. And you realize, God, America and Hollywood, they weren't ready for this. They were not ready for this at all. And they didn't know what to do with it.
The thing that confuses me the most about that movie is like they'll have like a scene, somebody will be talking and doing these things, and then they'll do like these flashbacks and they'll show like clips from old Hollywood films like Oliver Hardy. And you're like, what is going on here? Why are you doing this? They're going to like punch up the movie with this, but it's terrible.
That was the director's aesthetic choice. And there are rumors that he was like high on cocaine in the editing room and would just bring in reels of black and white stock footage or anything. And I believe that the studios got sued
for
using some of that footage without permission.
Now, who really hated that film too is Raquel Welch, and she said working with Mae West was a nightmare, and she firmly believes that Mae West was a drag queen. She's just like, I don't believe that she's a real woman.
she's really spread that rumor.
Yeah. And she said that like Mae West was just terrible to work with, and like in the scenes, like she was like always trying to like hide her in the light or hide her in darkness and do different things. So she said she really had to finagle her way through all the scenes that she ever did with her.
Well, you watch the film and you can totally tell that Raquel Welch is not happy, and she's very sort of like Gina Gershon in Showgirls is sarcastically delivering her lines throughout the film.
Well, the other thing too is like it was supposed to be like a big breakout role for her. You know, because she had had some other acting experience, but like this was going to be her big thing. And then it was just like, it just turned into be her big headache.
Did she do like a 10,000 BC with Ringo Starr or something? She played his wife.
No, she did like 10,000 BC, but I don't think she did the one with Ringo Starr. Oh, okay. She did some other ones, yeah.
But she played a cave woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she didn't have the best movie roles, but she, in Latin America, Raquel Welch was considered a sex icon.
Well, in America as well.
But I mean, like I remember as a kid, there were like love songs written for her in Spanish.
Aww.
Mentioning her name.
Because she was Latina, right? Wasn't she Mexican?
I don't
know.
She's
Mexican, yeah.
Is she?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
I thought she was like, also, what is Raquel Welch's heritage? I'm thinking Sophia Loren.
Yeah, she's Italian.
Yeah, yeah. So, these two women were very beloved.
Another guy who I wanted to bring up too is like, you know, because we talked about Barbarella, because Pygar, the guy who played Pygar, John Philip Law, for the longest time, his IMDb was only for Barbarella. And I thought, well, isn't that kind of weird that he only made this one film? And so as we're doing research for the show, I went back and checked, and it was like somebody beefed up his IMDb. So he did a lot of work in Europe. And so he did make lots of films, but for whatever reason, for a decade, I want to say Beer Barella, because you do that parody.
Yeah.
An angel does not make love because an angel is love.
I think we should do some honorary mentions here to Dwayne Jones, who was in, I'm sorry.
You okay, baby?
Yes.
Do you want to take like a little breather?
I just want to do a little breather.
Rambling yourself into
No. I want to do. There. Let's do some honorable mentions here to Dwayne Jones, who was a Night of the Living Dead, 1968 cult classic, because he made that movie, and then he made a movie a couple years later, like in the mid 70s, and then he didn't make any other movies again until like the 80s.
Yeah.
So for whatever reason, like you know, doing that role. Even though it's so iconic, it didn't really turn out into real work for him. Because I think that movie challenged people on a couple of different levels, you know, because it had a lot to do with race relations in the United States at the time. And, you know, he was a handsome fellow, and there's a scene where he, like, you know, he's inside with this white woman, and you're kind of like, oh my God, is this white woman safer outside with the zombies, or is she safer inside with this African-American guy?
Well, that's the other thing about that movie that, contextually, people forget is not only was it groundbreaking in terms of it being a new kind of zombie movie that was truly terrifying, but it was also groundbreaking to make Dwayne Jones the lead of that film at that time. You know, a black man to be the hero, to be the savior, to be the protagonist was unheard of, you know, and it was because it was such a low budget indie film that, you know, George Romero was able to like do that. If it were a Hollywood film, it would not, he would not have been able to cast him.
Right. And now, nowadays we have like zombies, like movies everywhere. We have zombies on TV, but at the time before this, if, correct me if I'm wrong, the zombie movies that were out there, they were like usually like Haitian voodoo zombies kind of, this was like a whole new kind of zombie where like the dead rose up and were like coming after the living.
For sure. It launched, there would be no Walking Dead without Night of the Living Dead. It gave birth to that modern idea of the zombie. And that casting dilemma, what's so sad about it is we are still not that evolved. This year was really great, you know, because of Mad Max and Star Wars, but in general, Hollywood still has problems making people of color or women, you know, the lead, the hero. But this goes to show you how exciting it was back then to actually, you know, have someone like Dwayne Jones play that character.
Also, who should get honorable mention is Sam J. Jones, who played Flash Gordon in the 1980s. I guess it was, you know, it's a cult classic for a lot of people, the sci-fi, where he played Flash Gordon. He's a football player, and they travel through, like, this other dimension to the planet Mongo, and they have to fight Ming the Merciless.
And, his dialogue was all dubbed, poor thing.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Because, like, dubbed by somebody else?
Yeah, by another actor.
Oh, I had no idea.
Why did they dub his lines?
Sometimes you watch those performances where you're like, God, there's something weird about this.
Yeah. They do that a lot in Star Trek. So if you watch Star Trek, you'll see a lot of times they're because they go in and re-record things.
Right.
So that it comes through so it's more clear.
Well, all the Klingons, anybody who has lots of teeth, Ferengi, they all go in and re-record their lines because you can't talk too much. All those teeth in their mouth keeps them from enunciating their lines.
Well, and Sam had posed for Playgirl, and after the movie came out, they reran the photos, and I remember that making like a big scene when we were kids. And he had done some movies beyond after that, but just never ever to that level. And of course, you know, we all know it too, because it's like, you know, Queen's theme song for that movie was just such a big hit. That's so gay.
Well, what about the boy who played Charlie in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory?
Well, I don't know if we could really call him Beefcake. Maybe he's
no.
He grew up to be a leather daddy.
But he was, you know, I have to say though, when I was a little kid, I had a crush on him because he was such a cute little kid, you know. And it was the only movie he ever made. He grew up to be a veterinarian, and I saw pictures of him where he's wearing like, you know, just a leather vest and jeans and like a leather vest. I'm like, I'm going to have to guess that he's gay. If you're wearing just a leather vest and jeans, you know.
Yeah, and a big handlebar mustache, too. I mean, he looked like he was right there at a leather conference or something.
But not Beefcake because he's a little kid.
Well, maybe because we couldn't come up with very many other examples. Maybe the listeners can post in the comment section all the ideas that we missed. Because I have a feeling that there's a bunch more and we just...
This is just part one, Peaches. This is just part one. Yeah. Oh, and that's the thing, so we can find out more. Because especially, you know, when you go and delve into, like, the horror genre, there has to be, like, so many of these movies that are classics that people have only just done that one film.
Well, one actor of color that I'm kind of curious about is actor Ken Norton, who played the hunk boxer Meaty in the film Mandingo in 1975. He, like a lot of these Hollywood hunks, you know, did a couple of roles before or after and then just fell off the face of the earth, and then 30 years later came back as a sort of, you know, vintage celebrity. And I'm wondering if, you know, Peaches, because you were friends with a lot of filmmakers, you've made major box office hits yourself. Is it hard? Is there something about being an actor, especially a Hollywood hunk, that we're just not seeing that is just so goddamn miserable that it makes these guys run screaming from the experience.
I don't think so. I don't know. I don't know what I can't. That's why it's sort of baffling. The only thing that I kind of have come up with is that they may be cast, you know, more based on their looks or their bodies. And so if they didn't have a certain amount of ability or talent as on-screen performers, that they wouldn't get cast again. Mm. But I don't know. I mean, maybe they choose to leave the business because, like Mark said, they felt exploited. I really don't know. It'd be interesting to go and ask them. Mm. You know, maybe someone should do a documentary or something.
Mm. Well, and I'm wondering, you know, like the season 7 of RuPaul's Drag Race was sort of tainted or very criticized because a lot of the top drag queens from the season didn't want to be actors. They wanted to be models, like right. Pearl it was more and about the Violet. Look. Yeah, mm-hmm. And literally, they've been getting gigs, working runways, and trying to be more, fashion queens than comedy queens or performance queens,
right?
And I'm just wondering, like, if this is kind of tied to each other in the sense that a lot of these guys don't enjoy the process of acting in front of a camera or on stage.
Well, plus when you're in Hollywood too, there's that they say, you know, I don't know if it's still the same, but they have the casting couch. And so maybe they just weren't into sucking all that cock that they needed to suck to keep their career going.
Well, that could be
more than
too.
One Hollywood actor that started out as a hustler.
A lot of them
that's
do.
True.
Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these early bodybuilders and physique guys paid for their food and their training and their gym memberships
with muscle worship.
By going to rich men's homes and flexing and possibly doing other sexual things. But, you know, they were certainly like very comfortable in putting themselves in homoerotic situations early on in their careers.
And that guy who did the TV show Hung. You know that actor? I forget his name, but he said that he was a hustler in Hollywood when he first started out. Thomas Jane, that was it. Yeah, he said that he did male prostitution when he was young, and so I think it prepared him for his role as a male prostitute.
How is that show? I haven't seen it.
You know, I watched some of it, but I don't have HBO anymore, and I do believe it was canceled. It was on for like two or three seasons.
So I've been enjoying OJ.
You know, I haven't seen it at all.
It's very, I find it to be very satisfying and delicious.
And the new theory is he didn't kill her.
It was his son.
It was his son, Jason, who was working at a restaurant, and Nicole was supposed to come and eat with a bunch of her friends, and he made her all this food, and she didn't show up.
She blew him off.
And he has a mental disorder, and then he went and killed her, and so OJ helped cover it up because he didn't want his son to go to jail. That's what a new documentary is coming out and saying.
So wow. We'll see.
So he, you know.
And the reason that the police didn't go that route is because they were so on framing OJ that they tainted their own evidence, mm-hmm. and so it became a cover-up of the LA Police Department's ineptitude.
So they couldn't go back and be like, well, we changed this, you know, so it was, it'll be interesting to see how it goes down.
So but there are
like,
two
that's
cover-ups.
Not to say that he didn't, you know, that he wasn't abusive to his wife, because he was.
Or that he didn't do a crime that mm-hmm. he should spend the rest of his life in prison for as well. You know, mm-hmm. but it is. So I guess, you know, white people and black people can be at peace with each other because OJ didn't do it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he is guilty of heinous crimes and deserves to go.
Well, I worked at Michael Jordan's restaurant, so I worked with a lot of African-Americans while the trial was going on. And there was some women that I worked with. They're just like, I just can't believe he did it. He just didn't do it. And in my mind, I'm like, of course he did it. Why wouldn't he do it? You know, so I wonder if it was just my, you know, prejudiced.
Yeah. Well, that was like, that's one of the things about the timing of this TV show that's so fascinating is sort of any of us that lived through that and were here, especially in the United States, because I know for my partner, Nihat, he doesn't really get it the way that I do because they didn't experience it the same way in Turkey where he was. Mm-hmm. And I'm explaining it to him like, you don't understand, like this was the entire country was gripped by this. And you did not escape it, and it took over all of our lives. And when they announced the verdict, what was so shocking for white America was to realize how different our points of view were, because I mean, everyone can remember, if you were in a mixed environment, that white people reacted one way and black folks reacted another. And even though it was 2 years after Rodney King, we just didn't have the perspective, and in our own sort of white privilege and denial, didn't want to believe, you know, that it was that bad for black folks, or that the police were so awful. And I think what's interesting about this TV show coming out right now is it's after years, you know, the last few years of just atrocious reality banging us over the head. And unless you're just a completely ignorant, you know, racist,
hashtag
you
cannot all lives deny.
What?
Yeah. Well, hashtag. Yeah. I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement, if you don't get it at this point, I don't even know that you just
you're not listening. You're not paying attention.
You're a racist. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're not listening. And so that's why I think in some ways I'm so gripped by this show now, because that thing that was so boggling to us as white folks then, and I was young, I was in college, you know, is a lot easier to understand now when you watch them put Mark Furman on that jury box, or sorry,
on the stand
and the witness stand, and find out that he uses the N-word regularly. Mm-hmm. Well, if he's the guy collecting the evidence, you know, like, it all makes sense in a way that it didn't. You know, back then we all looked at each other like, how could they not find him guilty? You know, well, I don't know. I actually think the whole thing is the perspective with which we can watch this thing now is what makes it so satisfying as a work of art. And also, Sarah Paulson is so brilliant, and, you know, the performances are great, and, you know, Ryan Murphy's great at creating entertainment. So it's not, you know, it is entertaining and it's wildly, you know, dramatic. But it's also socially so relevant right now.
And, you know, the biggest crime of all is that the trial that it was called the Trial of the Century launched the Kardashian media empire.
Even the way that's weaved in, I think, is really interesting, because I find Kris Jenner to be a repugnant person.
Yeah.
But watching Selma Blair play her, and for her to be the first to say, you know, he did this and I want to help put him away, while her ex-husband and her are arguing, and to have that sort of perspective about Kris Jenner is interesting. You know, it's all very fascinating. And, you know, they introduce the kids, you know, and, you know, there's a whole sequence where OJ's, you know, threatening to blow his brains out, and, you know, you realize he's in Kim Kardashian's bedroom, and, you know, like, the way that they, whether it's true or not, some of the stuff that they do is sensational. And I think most of it's true, because I went online and started, you know, watching these Marsha Clark interviews and stuff, where she's like, yeah, basically this is true. This stuff that you wouldn't even think is true, like a lot of the flirtation and behind the scenes stuff, nobody's really denying that it's inaccurate. I recommend it a lot. I think it's really interesting.
Well, I'm super excited to see you in Austin, Texas later this month at the Austin International Drag Festival.
I can't wait. We're going to have fun. When do you guys get there?
We're going to get there on like Tuesday, I think, and then we leave like the next Tuesday, because Fausto's family's there, so we kind of use this as an opportunity to have a little family reunion.
Well, that's good, because they're flying me in on Wednesday at 6 in the morning for some reason.
Oh, that's great.
I have no idea why. I don't do anything until Thursday. I'll come pick you up at the airport. Yeah, I was going to say, I'll be waking up at 4 a.m. in San Francisco, and I'll have an entire day in Austin with nothing to do.
Oh my God, we'll go to Barton Springs. Bring your swimming suit.
I will. I would love that.
Okay, we'll go hang out.
So, no photos.
No.
What? Like, why not?
I'm rocking my beach body,
I'm not
baby.
Photographed topless.
We'll get you in the water. Crazy? We'll photograph you.
I'll Photoshop you in abs like I do for myself and Mark.
Yeah.
You could put me, my head on the body of any of these disposable hunks.
Okay, so
wait,
hot,
so wait, we want to promote. We have to promote okay. something.
Okay,
Our own live podcast at the Austin Drag Festival mm-hmm. that's happening at 3 p.m. in the afternoon on Thursday that weekend.
Oh, I should come to that.
Yeah, would you like to show up and drag and be part of it?
Hell no.
Oh, come on, people would love to see you. What?
Well, you only want to see
can't you
me
do
there
like drag? Can't you do like half very, drag or something or like low drag? Because Mark and I are going to dress up in drag for
we
it.
We are?
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise.
And we're doing a drag number. Is a state of the drag verse address. Redress.
Well,
so we're going to be talking about all the important, significant drag.
Oh no! What time is your thing on Thursday?
It's in the afternoon. It's not during your own thing.
Oh, good. Okay, yes. My thing starts at 3:30. So
what time's ours too?
I think they're not at the same time. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Just, well, I'll go to yours, and then you guys can come to mine.
Excellent. I'm so excited for yours too. You're doing the Girls Will Be Girls reunion.
No, mine on Thursday is the Children of the Popcorn.
Oh.
And I'm doing, so they might have you. So Feast of Fun Live is at 2 p.m.
My thing's at 3:30.
Yeah. So it's one right after the other, and it's in the same space. It's at the Holiday Inn in Midtown on Fiskville Road.
Will you be in drag for your event, the Children of the Popcorn?
No, no. Okay. So, because the whole idea is I'm doing a workshop on the behind the scenes, being a self-produced queen, how to not rely on others to be your producer, your writer, your director, mm-hmm. how to create your own cult or your own business. And so I'm leading it as Joshua.
Okay.
And then on Friday, I'll be Peaches. I'm hosting the Girls Will Be Girls reunion show, and I'm doing Dragula that night. So I'll be Peaches all day and night on Friday. So mm-hmm. you know, you can pick my brain as Joshua on Thursday and come see me as Peaches on Friday.
Now the Girls Will Be Girls reunion takes place at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Just so you know that.
Mine says 12:40. I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, it says. Well, that's what, this
maybe
is
that's
crazy.
Your call
they have,
time.
They have two things listed in the event, but they said that it's limited seating. So if you're planning on going there, show up at least an hour early mm-hmm. to get into the room because it will sell out.
Okay.
So
let's rate our hunks that we talked about on our hotness scale, our disposable beefcake-o-meter. So the four, we have Dennis Bush, who played the vegetable in Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, Roger Heron, Rusty Godowski from Myra Breckenridge, David Gurian, who played Harris Ellsworth in Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and Peter Henwood, who played Rocky from Rocky Horror Picture Show. And your hotness from hottest to least hot, who would you like to sleep with the most?
Back then or today?
Well, back then, of course, from their
the vegetable.
Role. The vegetable is what? The hottest one for you?
Yes.
Okay, and second?
I think maybe the guy from Myra Breckenridge.
Okay.
Rusty.
So Rusty.
Yeah, Rusty.
A third?
Let's see, who's left? Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
Yes, David Gurian or Peter Hunwood from Rocky?
I think David.
And so lastly would be Rocky?
Yeah, you know, I never really was that into Rocky. Yeah. Is that rude?
I wasn't either until I saw that dick, and now I'm like, well, what?
Are you a size queen?
In some respects. No, you know what? It's not really important to me, the size of a penis, but it's like when you have a good-sized penis, then it's I'm an admirer.
Right, like if you see excited. A pretty one and it looks good, you know, you're not,
So for my list, I would, because I'm a sucker for a guy with like a hairy chest, blue eyes, and dark hair.
Oh, thank you.
So I would definitely go with David Gurian from Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. And then after that, I would pick Dennis Bush, the vegetable, because I like a blonde guy with muscles. And then I'm kind of like between Peter Henwood, Rocky, because that dick... versus Rusty Godowski. I don't know. I think I'd probably go with Rusty Godowski and then Rocky last. Fausto?
So we're similar.
Yeah.
So we're choosing from the four or five?
The four.
Okay. So we're not including John Philip Law, Pygar.
No, because he had more films under his belt. And he's kind of like a honorable mention.
He's trash.
And he would be at the bottom of my list anyway.
Yeah, me too. He's like a circuit party guy.
I don't know. For me,
he's wearing angel wings. Yeah.
He's wearing angel wigs. And he's sort of like greased up.
Yeah.
I feel like Roger Heron is the least appealing of the four of them. And part of it is that he struck me as an unhappy person in the role that he was in. Yeah. The other guys seemed like, you know, new things were happening. So when you look at them in their appearance in these films, Peter Hinwood, David Gurren, and Dennis Bush, they all seem kind of like stuff is happening. Yeah. They're energetic. Their presence in the film is
enthusiastic.
Roger seems like, you know, he's held at gunpoint throughout most of the film, and it seems very unhappy. So, you know, he doesn't strike me as somebody very sexy.
So he's the bottom of your list.
Dennis Bush, because of the fact that he's so voluptuous, and he's in some ways an innocent character in Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. And, of course, that just remarkable body. And,
yeah.
And
Faust is a muscle chaser.
Well, and also, I think, you know, he's the only character in the film that they actually sort of, like, show making out and making love with one of the female leads. You know, all the other guys are sort of in a fight or in a dysfunctional relationship, or they're, you know, running away from somebody who's sexually attacking them, like Peter Hinwood in Rocky Horror Picture Show. He's being chased by people throughout the film, and he turns to Susan Sarandon sort of to nurture his fears. So it's you know, he's not as a sexually appealing. David Gurion is very sweet and very innocent, but I think Dennis Bush wins as the hottest of the Hollywood's forgotten hunks.
Okay.
Wow, that was quite an answer.
So your list is, so you say Dennis Bush first.
Yeah. Dennis Bush first.
And then David Gurion.
David
Gurion. Then Rocky, and then Rusty?
Yes.
Okay.
Rusty seemed so unhappy.
Yeah.
And you know, you just know this guy, like, he was a volleyball player and in the military, and then he became this actor, and it just struck me as somebody who was like, didn't know what to do with his life. Whereas Peter Hinwood seemed like a gay guy who was having fun throughout the whole time. And certainly Dennis Bush, he strikes me as somebody who looks back at his experience in Russ Meyer's Faster Pussycat Kill Kill is with a lot of fondness.
Well, he lives in San Diego now, you said. That's kind of like a muscle capital of the world. A lot of bodybuilders go there to die.
And Dennis Bush still looks good to this day, and so does Rainer Burton. They're still, you know, I think part of it is it's you know, beauty is something that it's a mindset, it's a lifestyle. It's not just something that you do when you're young and then you discard it as you age. It's about taking care of yourself and loving yourself and being a happy person.
And don't dispose of your own beefcake ability, right?
Yeah.
Just keep working at it.
That's right.
Exactly.
Peaches, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking about all these hot men with
us. For having me.
Oh, yeah. Anytime,
I'll see you guys soon in Texas.
I'll see you in Texas. The stars are big, big so and bright.
We're going to go to Texas. Yes, deep in the heart of Texas. We're going to go to the Springs. And
should we join Christine? Should we invite Christine and Downer?
Oh, yeah, let's invite Christine for sure. You know, she and I went cruising together. So we like to swim. We both like to swim together. So I'll reach out and invite Christine, and we'll spend Wednesday together if you guys have the time.
We have the time.
Yeah, all we need to do is we need to do a sound check for our podcast on Thursday.
Fears.
Hey, I also need a camera person to run our video camera for the live podcast.
Anybody in Texas want to volunteer?
Peaches? Let us know.
I'll do it if you have the camera.
Yeah, we have the camera.
Of course, why not?
If I can't find anybody else, because I might need you for the live podcast, because we're really trying to get, like, you know, a wide variety of drag queens, but you always have such interesting things to say about the state of the union of drag.
Hello. Well, as long as you're comfortable with me being out of drag, I'm all for it.
Well, can you bring something colorful and visual to wear, even if it's not peaches? Like maybe like a piece of clothing or something that you own that has visual significance to your career.
Of course. That's what I always do.
That way it's a good compromise, because it's like...
I will have you know that I am sitting in my mother's home wearing a sweater with the triptych face of Anton LaVey on it.
Ooh.
So, you know...
Oh, my God.
Why? I don't...
For people who don't know Anton LaVey, he was a famous Satanist. Yeah.
He was the founder of the Church of Satan. And, yeah.
His daughter's still very active in it, right?
My clothes, I would wear something of interest.
Because I think that the big critique from last year is, I guess one of the drag queens didn't want to be in drag.
Mm-hmm.
But she, so she started calling the other guests of our podcast, telling them that they didn't need to show up in drag for
like,
it.
Don't show up in drag because I'm not showing up in drag.
And so then Lady Red Couture got a wind of this, and she was furious.
She outed them.
Was it, the thing about it is, as long as it's pre-negotiated, you know, so like with me, I'm being clear up front. I don't want to be in drag on Thursday because I have to be in drag for 12 hours on Friday. You know, I think, you know, but if you ask other queens, are you willing to come and drag, then they should go and drag. You know, I always stick to my word, but I'm also pretty upfront about it. I'm not gonna, you know, if someone tries to book me for something and I don't want to do it in drag, like a radio interview or something like that, I'll say, well, I can do it, but I'm not gonna come in costume, you know.
But bring like something flashy, because it is being videotaped, so it's, we need to see something interesting.
Okay.
Like, okay, surprise us with, because you have so many cool things in your storage locker and in your wide collection of clothing, both male and female.
Okay, I'm going to look like a damn fool. And then you guys are going to be like, what the fuck?
We can't use this footage.
And then
I'm going
to explain it to the audience.
No, Mark and I, this is, do you want me to tell you?
No, you're not going to tell it.
We're working round the clock on creating some amazing looks.
He just came up with this harebrained idea.
Well, join the club.
Peaches, listen, we got to run. But I want to thank you for coming on the podcast, and we'll see you soon, baby.
Yeah, see you soon. All right, take care.
Do you want to let go of Peaches before you tell people where she lives?
Peaches Christ.
Her address is...
Peaches Christ lives in San Francisco. You can find out more about Peaches at peacheschrist.com.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, Hollywood hunks.
I know.
It seems like we really scratched the surface, and I feel like the story of gorgeous white men struggling to...
Hey, we shoehorned a black guy in there.
I did, a couple of black men, you know, but it really is like the story of male privilege and how it's not always as glamorous as it seems.
Is that right?
Maybe. And I don't know. But it is sort of like a lot of these guys, especially I feel like Roger Heron seemed like really distraught at his appearance in the film and the fact that he like got fucked by Raquel Welch in the movie.
He pegged her.
Whereas Dennis Bush and Peter Hinwood seem like pretty happy with the experience. Mm. David Gurian...
Ran screaming from Hollywood.
I'm sure he changed his name legally. I called a bunch of people. He literally, like, within a year of making that film, disappeared and was never heard from or seen again. And maybe
freaky.
You know, yeah. Guys, we want to thank you so much for listening to today's show. Remember, Feast of Fun is made possible because of financial support of fabulous people like you. Go to feastoffun.com/plus and become a member today, because without your financial support, we can't pay the internet hosting costs, the production costs to make this podcast. It's available to you free without any commercial interruption. And the only way that it happens is because you took time out to become a Plus member.
We also have fantastic t-shirts for sale at our store, feastoffun.com/store. Get your Not Shaven Gives Me More Time for Misbehaving t-shirt or your Hunty t-shirt, Eleganza, Fabulosity. What does it say?
What's it Eleganza say? Extravaganza.
Shantae, you stay t-shirt. Save for more.
The shade is strong with this one. And reading is fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
And all those wonderful catchphrases that you hear RuPaul or drag queens say, we include it, you know? And so what do you think about the last year of the State of the Union of drag? Mm-hmm. What's...
what have been some of the big highlights that we've talked about? And let us know. Write in the comments. Do you think that we forgot about a beefcake that needed to be remembered? Mm-hmm. Please let us know. Feastoffun.com.
Yeah, post a comment on this show. Let us know.
Bye, everybody.